Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for early summer registration is July 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us today, Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa, Donna Hoffman, in our Cedar Falls studio. Hi, Donna. Donna, are you there?
I am. I'm here now.
Yes, we can hear you loud and clear now. Thank you for joining us today and stepping into our studio. In our Iowa City studio, Tracy Osborne, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Tracy, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Want to reach out to our listeners as well as we go through a handful of topics, one dominating. You will know about that in just a moment. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or river to river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Well, let's talk about this feud, this firestorm, lots of words to describe it, and get your analysis on it, Tracy and Donna. Yesterday, U.S. House lawmakers voted to condemn President Trump's attacks on 4 Democratic congresswomen as, quote, racist comments that have legitimized increased fear and hatred of new Americans and people of color. Now, on Sunday, this goes back to the president tweeting that women should, in his words, these women, these 4 members of Congress, should go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came. And he has since defended his comments, tweeting again he does not have a racist bone in his body. Now, it's notable here, all 4 lawmakers, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts, and Rashid Tlaib of Michigan are U.S. citizens. 3 were born in the U.S. Let's listen to the president doubling down on his tweet during a Q&A with press at a Made in America manufacturing event at the White House on Monday.
If you're not happy here, then you can leave. As far as I'm concerned, if you hate our country, if you're not happy here, you can leave. And that's what I say all the time. That's what I said in a tweet, which I guess some people think is controversial. A lot of people love it, by the way. A lot of people love it. But if you're not happy in the U.S., if you're complaining all the time, very simply, you can leave. You can leave right now. Come back if you want. Don't come back. It's okay, too. But if you're not happy, you can leave.
Okay. Also on Monday, we heard from what has been named the squad, these 4 representatives. Let's listen to one of them. They had held a press conference on Monday. This is freshman Representative Ayanna Pressley, a Democrat from Massachusetts, responding to Trump's tweet. She spoke at this press conference surrounded by the 3 others in the so-called squad.
From our colleagues to our neighbors, we are grateful for your solidarity, your encouragement, and your support in the face of the most recent xenophobic, bigoted remarks from the occupant of our White House. I will always refer to him as the occupant, as he is only occupying space. He does not embody the grace, the empathy, the compassion, the integrity that that office requires and that the American people deserve. That being said, I encourage the American people and all of us in this room and beyond to not take the bait. This is a disruptive distraction from the issues of care, concern, and consequence to the American people, that we were sent here with a decisive mandate from our constituents to work on.
Ayanna Pressley, Democrat from Massachusetts. Donna, let me start off with you. There's so many facets, so many ripples sent out from that Sunday presidential tweet. What is first and foremost in your mind today, Wednesday?
Well, you know, this doesn't seem to be abating because this has been going on, as you noted, since Sunday. And then if we look at what happened on the floor of the House of Representatives yesterday, in terms of Representative Pressley in particular in her comments mentioned this being a distraction. There was a lot of time taken up on the House floor to approve this resolution, but then they got into some procedural drama that also took up more time. We're going to have, it looks like this afternoon or this evening, some more drama in terms of impeachment proceedings potentially. There'll be votes on various procedural votes on what takes place there. These four freshman members of Congress have carved out a unique identity for their constituents, but also I think others in the United States who look to them in particular as being women of color, as being particularly from the progressive bloc of the United States. And what this drama brings to the fore is really the divisiveness in the country surrounding policies that are being debated. So it's not just about some of the drama here, but I mean, it does go back to policy disagreements that are really escalating. One of the, you know, interesting procedural drama pieces that we had yesterday as the House was debating this resolution as to whether they would condemn Trump's remarks or not, was that the sitting speaker, which is not Nancy Pelosi, it's just the procedural speaker, vacated the chair for a period of time. And so there is a lot of drama, again, going on. And a lot of it is procedural things that the American public is not going to follow particularly closely. But it escalates kind of the tension that is in Washington, D.C., that we know a lot of the American public only pay some sporadic attention to. But when they do pay attention to it, they see this dysfunction. They see the disagreement. And many times that causes the public to turn against and not pay attention to politics. And that is really problematic for the body politic.
Mm-hmm. And in this program, I want to remind our listeners that we will get to other aspects here. This is being the first and foremost of the sort of political ripples on our landscape. But we will talk about some other things as well as time permits. That vote yesterday, Democrats condemning the president, a vote of 240 to 187, all Democrats voting yay. All of, certainly that means Iowa's congressional delegation, plus four in the Republican ranks, one independent there as well. Tracy Osborne, what do you have to add to what Donna said?
You know, I think for the most part, Donna captured a lot of the problems with that went on yesterday, but we see really two layers here. There's the layer of what went on inside Congress, which is, as Donna indicated, really inside politics, but shows how rancorous the parties are between each other. And then there, I think there's the bigger layer, which is this constant back and forth of what rallies a base. You know, Trump did this deliberately. He knows that that rallies his base. As he said in the clip that you played, you know, he knows that some people really like this tweet. And I don't think it's incidental that he picked on for women of color, you know, and that there's a gender and a racial ethnic dynamic there. But that plays well to his base. You know, he's had a lot of people retweeting this, talking about how excited they are about it. And I think, you know, part of it for him was sort of distracting from some frustrations he's having with the census, with the immigration policy, et cetera, right? Sort of bringing his base around something else. And on the other side, Pelosi's doing exactly the same thing. You know, she's a smart woman. She knew when she called President Trump racist and not the executive office racist, that she was violating congressional procedure. And I think she did it, honestly, deliberately, because it would make a bigger signal than just some inside game in Congress, right? She knew it would be repeated in Congress. But again, that unifies them as well.
Okay, let's go to what happened in the House yesterday with Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House. Republicans criticizing her for violating the House rules on decorum, which call for lawmakers to avoid impugning the motives of their colleagues or the president, as in this case. Let's play a bit of that audio. It is high drama, as you both mentioned, Donna and Tracy here. At the end of this, we'll hear the Georgia Republican Representative Doug Collins rising to challenge Nancy Pelosi while she's speaking and demand that her words be taken down. Let's listen to the audio and then have our two guests analyze a little, dissect what is happening here. This is yesterday in the U.S. House, Nancy Pelosi speaking.
It's so sad because you would think that there would be a given that we would universally in this body just say, of course, of course. But and there's no excuse for any response to those words but a swift and strong unified condemnation. every single member of this institution, Democratic and Republican, should join us in condemning the president's racist tweets. To do anything less would be a shocking rejection of our values and a shameful abdication of our oath of office to protect the American people. I urge a unanimous vote and yield back the balance of my
vote. I was just going to give the General Speaker of the House if she would like to rephrase that comment.
I have cleared my remarks with the parliamentarian before I read them.
And take it. And I ask the words be taken down. I make a point of order. The gentlewoman's words are unparliamentary and risk ready to be taken down.
Donna Hoffman, explain what's going on there a little more.
Well, so the rules of the House say that you are to avoid personal reference to the president, to the president's motive. You can't impugn the president's character. In that clip that you played, note that she said, everyone should join us to condemn the president's racist tweets. So she's characterizing the president's rhetoric here. The president's tweet is a splitting hairs, perhaps. Nevertheless, the House is nothing if not extremely procedurally complex. Okay. So then the Representative Collins is asking that her comments be taken down, that they be stricken from the congressional record, that there be no record of them. She gets the opportunity to withdraw those if she wants. And she says, no, I'm not going to withdraw them. I've cleared them with the parliamentarian. And then from there, it escalates. And what we end up with at the end of the day is that, as I mentioned earlier, Representative Cleaver gets a little frustrated with things on both sides, I think, from his remarks, vacates the chair. Steny Hoyer, who's number two in the House on the Democratic side, comes up, does rule that her remarks are out of order, but then there is a vote taken on that. There's several procedural votes here, and her remarks are not taken down. That vote to take down her remark fails. And in essence, this makes for a new precedent in the House. The vote on that. And then from there, they go on to the actual resolution that condemned the president's racist tweets. And that, you know, the language in the resolution was echoed and mirrored by Nancy Pelosi in her remarks on the floor.
Mm-hmm. To add to that, Tracy?
I don't. I think that's a pretty good explanation. You know, I think one thing to keep in mind here is most people are not going to understand the parliamentary stuff that went down. And so I think in the long term, that's going to be pretty inconsequential, but except perhaps, as Donna mentioned, in the House itself by setting a new precedent.
Okay, let's go to our callers. If you've just joined us, Tracy Osborne with us at the University of Iowa, also political scientist at Donna Hoffman at the University of Northern Iowa. As always on Political Politics Wednesday, trying to get a lot in a very short time. Let's go to our callers. I'm going to ask our callers that we have on to be brief, get right to the nugget of what you want to say. Chris in Des Moines, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I just wanted to say real quick, the problem is we have a president that is very bigoted. And then when you go around and you ask other bigots if this guy is a bigot, of course they're going to say he's not a bigot because you're asking a bigot about a bigot. And what this is also doing to the Republican Party, if they're not being any wise about this, it is making them look like the whole Republican Party is nothing but a bunch of bigots.
Okay, Chris, so in Des Moines, let's pick up with that point. Tracy Osborne, do you see the risk here for the Republican Party? We want to talk a little bit about how Congress, our Republican members of Congress, have been reacting to this episode.
Yes, I think the most prominent was actually Joni Ernst, who very clearly said, you know, I don't like his tweets, but I like his policies, and so therefore I'm not going to condemn him. And I think that's mostly the line Republicans have taken. You know, very few have come out to say anything explicit against the rhetoric itself. But for Republicans, this is kind of a funny line because, honestly, as I said before, I think in part Trump is playing to his base. And so he knows that there's a fair number of Republican people who are actually okay with that kind of language. And that doesn't mean all Republicans are okay with that kind of language. It means that the Republican Party itself has to find that line where suddenly they're not okay with it. And it flips things around and starts going against the president. And honestly, I don't get the feeling from this tweet that this is that moment.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Let me share some poll numbers. This is, I'm getting this from Susan Page writing in USA Today. A clear majority of Americans say President Trump's tweets targeting four minority congresswomen were, quote, un-American. This is according to the new USA Today Ipsos poll. But most Republicans say they agree with his comments, an illustration of the nation's sharp partisan divide. Here we have, Donna, two-thirds of those aware of the controversy, 68% of them call these tweets offensive. But among Republicans alone, 57% said they agreed with the tweets that told these congresswomen to go back to their original countries, and a third strongly agreed with him. Well, what does this tell you about the divide in our country, Donna?
Well, it captures some of the emotional aspects of that divide. And, you know, there are, you know, Tracy mentioned Senator Ernst, you know, comments, this compartmentalizing that some Republicans try to do, in that I don't like his language, but I like his policies and moving forward. And so the public is seeing that. Many times in public opinion polling, their questions are worded in such a way that can prompt people to answer in an emotional way.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are answering in an emotional way, they're not necessarily answering in a more thoughtful and rational way. And this has become part of the touchstone of American politics, is that before we give some voters, before they give an opinion on some kind of policy issue, may first want to know, well, is this the Republican stance or is this the Democratic stance? Because they just parrot that particular kind of position. And that position divides us. And there is not always thoughtful contemplation and nuance in terms of looking at the kind of language here, and polls don't do a good job of capturing that many times. And so, you know, one of the challenges as an educator, for example, that I always confront in a classroom is that oftentimes students, especially the students that we deal with, college students, want answers to be black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And they are not. They're nuanced. And polls don't always do a good job capturing that. And at the same time, they are capturing that tribalism about politics, about partisanship that we have being so endemic right now.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to our phones. At least one more call. Tom is calling from Fort Dodge. Have to ask you to make it brief, Tom, but we're sure glad you're joining us. What is your input here?
My input is simply that, as one of your guests described it, the propensity to rise to the bait. And what we've known for 2.5 years, our elections have been interfered with. And what we've had since then have been distractions in the form of, well, in every form that was available, and takes our eye off the ball. Our elections are not safe. Our government is not responsive. The Democratic Party, has a political calculus of the next election, which is not good for us. The Republican leadership is totally doesn't seem to be trustworthy at all. It's about us, and it's about time we woke up and actually looked in the mirror. It's about us.
Okay,
and it's for us.
Tom in Fort Dodge, thank you very much. There we hear Tracy Osborne. Exasperation with the entire whatever party, with our entire political system.
You know, I think Donna actually alluded to this before, that some people are getting very frustrated with this back and forth, kind of just griping at each other, you know, and it's a distraction from the issues. I think the caller is very right about that. The one thing I would say that maybe doesn't fit that is the Democrats actually had been seeing a little bit of dividing, right, and Congress over the more progressive wing, which is really represented by some of the women targeted by Trump's tweet, and Pelosi, who, you know, depending on kind of how you see her, would definitely be maybe a more conservative side of the Democratic Party. I don't think she's conservative, but on the not progressive. And so the problem here is actually this tweet in some ways may have unified them, right? It might have unified them around condemning this kind of language.
Okay, let's get to some of the other issues besides this, not that we're distracted here. Donna, I want to ask you about this new asylum rule of the Trump administration aimed at curbing the number of Central Americans claiming asylum in the U.S. This new measure says migrants would have to apply for asylum in the first country they pass through en route to the U.S. before applying for consideration to the U.S. So it means, for example, that an asylum seeker from Honduras may need to apply for asylum in Guatemala, neighboring Guatemala, before reaching the U.S. Tell us how this fits in with this administration, or what you see as how this fits into this administration's step-by-step progression here at trying to change our immigration laws and asylum rules.
Sure. It's in line with various other things that the Trump administration has done, many of them not going through in terms of courts, in terms of trying to alter the immigration rules, the asylum rules, and curbing the flow of migrants is trying to seek asylum into this country. The question with this new rule that's being put into effect is really how you will get Guatemala, Mexico to play along with this. And so far, the Guatemalan president was scheduled to come on Monday, presumably to talk about what is called a third country agreement. And he was kept from doing that by his country's legislature. Mexico has not been particularly willing to play along with this as well. And so the Trump administration has long been trying to put pressure on Mexico to have people stay in Mexico as they ask asylum. That was ask for asylum. That was a previous issue. Mm-hmm. Other countries in the Northern Triangle, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, to try to keep migrants from coming through, to try to keep Mexico from keeping those migrants coming through their borders. And this is just another policy try in this long line. Again, this is something that certainly will be challenged in courts. The ACLU has already indicated that they will be looking to challenge this particular rule.
Mm-hmm. Are we seeing, though, even though, let's say the president is fails here, that it's struck down by a court, we have this dominating headlines again and again, the immigration, and that this administration is showing this more aggressive posture towards asylum seekers and people coming into this country. Does it, even if these don't go into effect, Donna, have the effect that is desired by this administration?
Well, in some ways, yes, in some ways, no. I mean, if we look at the number of overall immigrants crossing the southern border, those numbers are actually down from the recent height of that in 2000. What has increased is families with children traveling. So there's, again, that nuance there that I spoke about earlier and how it relates to policy. But yet, at one level, you might think that families traveling with children, if they're hearing any kind of coverage of conditions and what is happening at our southern border, would not be doing that. But they aren't. They're coming. Now, they're also leaving what we know of as very bad conditions in their home countries. That's one of the reasons why they're venturing forward in a various dangerous area to try to get asylum. So I don't think there's a clear-cut answer to that question.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment. More from political scientist Donna Hoffman and Tracy Osborne as we continue with Politics Wednesday. When we come back, we'll continue with our Home State View series. Today, a Home State View of businessman, lawyer, the senior U.S. Senator from Colorado, also 2020 presidential candidate Michael Bennett. I'll be talking with Megan Verley of the Colorado Public Radio in just a moment. Of course, back with Donna and Tracy as well. I'm Ben Kiefer, Politics Wednesday on River to River.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for early summer registration is July 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
And we're back with this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our analysts this hour, Tracy Osborne, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, Donna Hoffman, Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. We'll have analysis, continued analysis from them in just a moment. I'm going to have them politely ask them to stand on the sidelines for just a moment as we continue our Home State View series, in which we focus on individual Democratic presidential candidates by talking with someone in the media from their home state who's been covering them for some time. Well, let's now get a Home State View of businessman, lawyer, and the senior U.S. Senator from Colorado and the most recently declared 2020 presidential candidate, Michael Bennett. Joining us to do that is Megan Verley. She's a public affairs editor with Colorado Public Radio and has covered state house and state politics for 8 years before becoming editor at Colorado Public Radio. Megan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I should mention that you covered the State House and state politics for a number of years before becoming editor. Tell us a little bit about the rise of Michael Bennett there in Colorado.
Well, he first entered public life here as the chief of staff, actually, for then-Denver Mayor John Hickenlooper, also in the 2020 Democratic field. So those two have a really long history together. He was at Denver City Hall for a couple of years. Then he was appointed superintendent of the Denver school system and attempted some very dramatic reforms there. And after a few years in that position, he was appointed to the U.S. Senate. So he's somebody who has clearly caught the eye of people around him and been sort of pushed up through the system. Although he was appointed to the U.S. Senate, he managed to win a strong primary challenge 2 years later and then hold that seat during the Tea Party wave, and he's won re-election once. So he's been on the scene here for quite a while now.
Mm-hmm. As a U.S. Senator from Colorado, what issues has he become known for among Coloradans?
Well, I think the one that he's known for nationally and that he also talks about a lot here at home is his participation in the Gang of Eight trying to get immigration reform. It's very much his style in that he got to the Senate and jumped into a giant sort of unsolvable issue and tried to solve it. And so even though it didn't go anywhere, it is still something that in Colorado, a state with a large Latino population, he talks about a lot and an effort that he worked hard on. He's also really worked on a lot of wilderness bills, which can matter a lot to people out here, trying to get more wilderness designations for parts of our mountains. Those also haven't gone forward, kind of the mark of being in the Senate these days. A lot of big ideas, but, you know, not always a lot of things across the finish line.
Mm-hmm. Megan, tell us about the team that he builds to support his efforts.
Well, I think he's one of our members of Congress who's not known for having a lot of turnover. You know, you don't hear a lot of drama out of his office. He really has tried to have smart people around him from the start. You know, you hear about his days, even in the Denver superintendent's office, really bringing in people that he knew actually from his background in the business community to help advise, to be mentors to kids. And he's really built himself a strong network in the state party as well. You know, it's hard, again, going back to that early education experience, he got crosswise with the unions and the teachers in that, and that can put you in a rough place in the Democratic Party. But so far, he's still managed to have a pretty broad base of support.
Mm-hmm. When he is criticized, when Michael Bennett, U.S. Senator from Colorado, is criticized, how does he react?
You know, it's funny, I keep going back to his days as superintendent, even though he's been a senator for quite a while now. But it was such a visceral and vivid time in Denver that it really stands out. One of his first acts as superintendent was to close a struggling high school that had a long history in the community, and he was deeply attacked for that. He was called racist. He was protested. And, you know, when you look at his response to that, it was to throw himself into trying to make sure that the kids who were losing their school stayed in school and didn't become a collateral cost of the reforms he was pushing. Now, how successful that was long term, I'm not sure anybody's really closed the books on it. But his response to doing something very controversial in that moment was not to back off, but to sort of double down on it in a way that both pushed what he wanted to do, but also tried to address the criticism that he was hearing.
Mm-hmm. Coloradans have been served by Michael Bennett as their U.S. senator for, 10 years now, since 2009. How would you judge his, or how would you say most Coloradans see his personal appeal?
You know, I think he does well in fitting into a mold of politician that we have a number of here in Colorado, including our Republican Senator Cory Gardner, which is to vote the ideals of your party, but to project a sort of friendly middle-of-the-road demeanor, no matter what your voting record looks like. So he's not been wildly confrontational in Colorado. He and Cory Gardner, for obvious reasons of political expediency, as well as maybe actual personal friendship, have until recently really tried to stand together as often as possible on issues, send out joint press releases, sort of emphasize how much they work across the aisle. And my theory of Colorado voters has always been that Colorado voters like to feel moderate, even if they are electing people who are not, at the end of the day, moderate, even if they are passing things like marijuana legalization. There's a baseline that in Colorado that likes to feel moderate, and I think Michael Bennett has tapped into that well.
In national news, not too long ago, in January of 2019, Michael Bennett got a lot of exposure for a fiery Senate floor speech.
These crocodile tears that the senator from Texas is crying for first responders are too hard for me to take. They're too hard for me to take. Because when the senator from Texas shut this government down in 2013, my state was flooded. It was underwater. People were killed. People's houses were destroyed. Their small businesses were ruined forever.
So, Megan, give us some background on what was happening then and talk about Michael Bennett in this case.
Well, the background on the speech itself is that he was talking about the 2013 floods in Colorado, which were absolutely devastating for portions of the Front Range. And, you know, I think the emotion around that and the anger around the federal response to that is very real. But I would say that a lot of us in the Colorado journalism world were pretty surprised by that floor speech, in the sense that I think that kind of moral outrage that you hear in that speech has been present at other times in public life. But for him to stand up on the Senate floor like that and just really lay into Senator Ted Cruz, those of us who had been hearing rumors of his presidential ambitions, I think that was the moment that it really confirmed it for us, because that was a whipping up the base moment that in the past in Colorado, I don't think he's had to do so much.
Megan, in closing, I wonder if you can tell us a little known fact about Michael Bennett that hasn't been covered so much.
Well, one thing that comes to mind is we just talked about that viral floor moment, but actually the viral video for Michael Bennett in state before that was he and Senator Gardner during the Winter Olympics tried to practice curling in the halls of the Senate. It was a very goofy moment for them, but that got passed around a lot, and sort of this genuine moment of humor between our two senators from opposing parties got a lot of attention. The other thing about him is that prior to public life, he worked for Phil Anschutz, who's a conservative investor, and one of the big things he did was consolidate a bunch of failing movie theater chains. So if you have ever gone to see a movie at a Regal movie theater chain, Michael Bennett is the one who actually put that company together.
Interesting. Very interesting. Thank you very much. Public Affairs Editor with Colorado Public Radio, Megan Verley. Thank you for your time and all of this background on Michael Bennett, 2020 presidential candidate.
Happy to do it.
And on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River, and back now to Tracy Osborne of the University of Iowa, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, our political scientists. We have just over 10 minutes left. Let's briefly stay on the 2020 presidential candidates theme there following that conversation with Megan. Let me turn to you, Tracy Osborne. Comment on what you heard there as Michael Bennett as a candidate or what you're seeing in this this continued crowded candidate field on the Democratic side.
Sure. It's really interesting to listen to because I'm a political scientist and I still have trouble naming all the people running for the Democratic nomination.
Not just you.
Yeah. What struck me there was immigration reform. I think there's two moments coming up where he could sell the fact that he's been involved in that. One of them is the upcoming Democratic debate, if he's on the floor. And then the second one is, you know, the Trump administration is working on what they're calling this sort of 90% fix of the immigration problems. They've been running it by a lot of Republican senators. Depending on the timing of the drop of that legislation, that might be the topic du jour. Mm-hmm. And so I'd be kind of interested to see how that plays out.
Mm-hmm. Donna, tell us, what are your observations? What are you seeing in terms of, I don't know, fundraising? The second quarter numbers just came out, or polling of these candidates that catches your eye, movement in the last few days or weeks?
Sure. Well, as you noted, Michael Bennett was one of the late entries into this field. So his fundraising numbers have reflected that. I mean, he is able to raise some money. He has some money on hand, looking at numbers from the second quarter reporting. And he's just gotten started kind of in that. But, you know, he comes across as very measured, but yet he has those moments where he can fight and is intense. And he's, you know, one of the things the reporter mentioned was that he's fairly pragmatic, looking for common ground type things. My concern with Michael Bennett is that this, within the Democratic field, this may not be the moment for that in terms of the Democratic base. It just kind of depends how issues like immigration continue to percolate in terms of policy, mm-hmm. And whether, you know, really the Republicans want that more of an issue, or do they really want to try to solve that problem and be pragmatic in that regard. And I think the jury's maybe a little bit out on that. And so Michael Bennett has some room, I think, to grow, especially here in Iowa, because he's not very well known, but he has a resume that he can run on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In the final few minutes, let's get to a couple of different items. One, state political news, but first, more to the federal side. Tracy, I want to ask you about a new ban that aims to block Planned Parenthood and other taxpayer-funded family planning clinics from providing abortion referrals. This means, I think, that clinics who receive family planning grants to provide services like birth control will risk losing their funding if they continue to provide abortion referrals. One of the several rules that take aim at what is called the Title 10 planning program. How does this fit into the Trump administration's wider stance on family planning and abortion access?
I think it fits right in line with what we've seen so far. There's been a lot of attacks on Title 10. You know, these clinics have been, you know, in some states they've already been shut down. In states like Texas, they've already been under threat. And so in some ways, this is just a continuance of that threat. I think, you know, this is one of those in the weeds issues where it's going to cause some Title 10 clinics to then struggle with their funding. But this, you know, talking about this gag rule on abortion is sort of like shifting the issue to the side, because taxpayers haven't been funding abortion for a really long time, right? So this is really just cutting off the ability of the Title 10 clinics, when they're talking about contraception, to have an abortion referral, right? So it's really like a small thing that sort of fits in line with the bigger picture of attacks on family planning, Title 10 clinics, and abortion availability. But, you know, so much of that happens at the state level. It's these kind of smaller things at the federal level that Trump can do. But there's a signal to the base, his pro-life base, that wants these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Donna, anything to add to or disagree with there?
No, I mean, I would agree with that. This is, you know, one of the issues that Trump uses to keep his base together, to try to keep them happy in terms of pushing the issue of restricting women's health funds. And this is in line with that.
Mm-hmm. Donna, let me ask you about a state political development this week. A jury that awarded a gay former state official $1.5 million in damages in this suit, finding that the former governor of Iowa, Terry Branstad, discriminated against him based on his sexual orientation. My information taken from the Des Moines Register. On Monday, the 8-person Polk County jury deciding that the state of Iowa and Branstad retaliated against this former Iowa Workers' Compensation Commissioner named Chris Godfrey, found that he and the state discriminated against Godfrey based on his sexual orientation. This is a case, I don't know, your thoughts on this case and the outcome, because it's been going on for, what, 6 years, I think, right?
Right. This is a really a long percolating issue. So Godfrey was originally appointed by Vilsack back in 2006 and then reappointed by Governor Culver. Obviously, both of those governors, Democrats. This is also a position, the Workers' Compensation Commissioner, that is Senate confirmed. So you have a term. It's a 6-year term, which is why when Branstad came in, he asked people serving in these kinds of positions, and Godfrey was one of them, to resign so that he could put his own people in there. Chris Godfrey was one of a small handful of them who refused to resign. And the governor had limited means then to get him to vacate the office. But one of the means he had was to cut his salary, which he did by something like $30,000. But Godfrey still would not resign, even in the face of that you know, monetary inducement. And then he did take a different job. And so the jury, as you mentioned, determined that this was discrimination and that it was discrimination based on Godfrey's sexual orientation. So there are damages that have been awarded to him, attorney fees that will be paid, that, and the amount of that, as I understand it, has yet to be determined. But these are fees and funds that the state will be on the hook for.
Mm-hmm. We have about 5 minutes left. Let me just turn to you and open this wide open. Other topics, Tracy, that we haven't talked about this hour, perhaps you'll be watching in the coming weeks. It's perfectly conceivable, in fact, likely that the big firestorm of this week will nearly be forgotten by next week because there'll be another firestorm, right?
Absolutely. You know, the one thing that I'm really watching right now is I think we're getting close to a whittling down of the Democratic field.
Okay.
Once they have their next debate, I think we're going to see some of the people that just aren't gaining traction start to drop off. And then we might really see some movement, right, once you open up that field. And we're really starting to see those five front runners emerge right now. But I keep reminding myself that, you know, if I rewind to 4 years ago, Scott Walker was the top person, right, for a long time here in Iowa. And so I keep reminding myself,
like,
right,
Scott Walker?
Who's that, right?
Yeah.
That, you know, you shouldn't get too excited now about who's at the top of the polls. But for me, watching that movement is really interesting and seeing Harris move up, you know, seeing Biden slip a little, kind of watching what's going on right now among Democrats.
Mm-hmm. What do you have your eyes on, Donna?
Yeah, I think the fundraising numbers, there are people in the second quarter who started spending more than they were taking in. They still have reserves that we should count in that. But I think you're going to see some of the people, we've already seen Eric Swalwell drop out. I think you're going to see some of those people who are not able to hit their fundraising targets going to have to really make a decision that they may have to drop out of the race. But at the same time, we do know about that fluidity. And so there will be an impetus that they might want to stay in. But the fiscal realities are going to hit some of those candidates. And with that, I have to bid you adieu for the afternoon.
Okay. Thank you very much. You have to go off to class. Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, thanks for jumping into our Cedar Falls studio in your busy teaching day. Tracy Osborne, let's continue with you for a few minutes. These numbers that we're talking about, the fundraising numbers, Pete Buttigieg at the top of the second quarter fundraising numbers, nearly $25 million. Dollars. Biden, $22 million. Warren, $19 million. I'm just progressing down the line. Bernie Sanders, $18 million. Kamala Harris, nearly $12 million. So in this country, this is the way, one of the necessary metrics, because we have this system, right? If,
absolutely.
I suppose if we were in Europe or another country that publicly funded their elections, this would not be a factor?
No, And the numbers are out. They're crazy, right? They're just outlandish. If you think this is the primary, this is just to get the nomination. It's not even, you know, talking about the general election yet.
Right.
Yes. I think it's easy sometimes when we see those numbers come out to lose track of the other side of this, which is the polling, you know, and talking about who's looking popular, who's, you know, gaining a little bit of traction, who's losing, not just numerically. I think some of the polls can be a little bit misleading. So there's a Quinnipiac poll out today that's, mm-hmm. you know, talking about Harris surging. Well, it's a California voters, so it's not really surprising that her name is more known in California.
Right. You need to look at the
right.
details of these polls sometimes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, mm-hmm. you know, to put those two things together and you start to see some emerging people, right? And that's really kind of what excites me, is to see who's picking up. And then if people start to drop out and then they endorse, you know, that could give a real boost financially or name-wise to, you know, a candidate that's on the up.
Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out, with the example of the former governor of Wisconsin being a big name here a few years ago and not. So the so-called front runners or the top of the heap that we have now could be flipped. We may look back in months or years and just say, wow, remember when?
Absolutely. Remember when we thought that Biden was going to win? But the other thing I would say, too, is you got to remember Trump didn't have the most money out of the Republican
right.
nominees last time. And so money isn't the only thing You know, it does allow you to compete in multiple states at one time, but it's not necessarily deterministic.
Right. And if Jeb Bush is listening, he will know better than anyone else. Quickly, how does a candidate evaluate whether to continue or drop out? Is it purely polling and fundraising? Are those the two metrics?
You know, I would guess it's actually hard for candidates a little bit because they're mostly on the ground in multiple states. And they're right now in, you know, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina. They might be getting a totally different response among South Carolina voters than they are among Iowa voters. And so they might be having that trade-off of, you know, what if I didn't do great in one and held off on the other? But if you're polling 1% right now, that's not a good sign.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tracy Osborne, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. We appreciate you coming into our studio, Tracy.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Rick Brewer, and Shirley Wong. Also help today from Camus Leeson. Tomorrow on the program, it's all about RAGBRAI 2019 and the new podcast that we'll be launching, Bike Shorts, River to River on Two Wheels. I'll be hosting that all next week. We'll talk about it tomorrow. You get a little bit of a preview. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.